Lincoln, Disc 12.
The House Divided quotation was one familiar to virtually everybody in a Bible-reading, church-going state like Illinois. It appeared in three of the Gospels. Lincoln himself had used the image as early as 1843 in urging party solidarity among the Whigs. The idea behind the metaphor, as he now used it, that slavery and freedom were incompatible, had been a standard part of the abolitionists' argument for decades. And in an 1852 speech, Edmund Quincy, the Massachusetts abolitionist, had used the House-divided quotation to predict the death of slavery. More recently, Southern apologists, such as George Fitzhugh, also argued that the United States must become all slave or all free. Lincoln had been thinking about this House-divided theme for several years. As early as 1855, after his first defeat for the Senate, he raised the question with a Kentucky correspondent, "Can we, as a nation, continue together permanently, forever, half slave and half free?" The next year, during the Fremont campaign, he several times announced his opinion that our government could not last part slave and part free. In December 1857, he drafted a speech arguing that the controversy over the Lecompton Constitution simply diverted attention from the true magnitude of the slavery element in this nation, which was dividing political parties and even churches along sectional lines. "A house divided against itself cannot stand," he concluded then. "I believe the government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. Whether this shall be an entire slave nation is the issue before us." In using almost identical words now, Lincoln was setting the stage for the longer second section of his address, designed to show that Douglas was part of a dangerous plot to nationalize slavery. As proof of that conspiracy, Lincoln evidenced first Douglas's Kansas-Nebraska bill opening all the national territory to slavery, which had upset a long-standing national consensus. Then he noted how President Franklin Pierce had pushed the bill to make it law. Next, President James Buchanan, in his inaugural address, fervently urged citizens to accept the still unannounced opinion of the Supreme Court on the extension of slavery, and Chief Justice Roger B. Taney immediately afterward ruled that all congressional legislation restricting slavery in the territories was invalid. Unlike most other Republican leaders, Lincoln didn't blame these measures extending slavery on the slave power, a phrase that he carefully avoided throughout the campaign, but attributed them to the Northern Democrats. He admitted that "we cannot absolutely know that these Democratic leaders were in a conspiracy, but," he said, using an image familiar to every Illinois farmer who had ever raised a barn, "when we see a lot of framed timbers, different portions of which we know have been gotten out at different times and places and by different workmen, Stephen, Franklin, Roger, and James," that is, Douglas, Pierce, Taney, and Buchanan, for instance, "and when we see these timbers join together and see they exactly make the frame of a house or a mill, all these tenons and mortises exactly fitting, and not a piece too many or too few," it was impossible not to believe that the four workmen had worked from a common plan or blueprint. In the pro-slavery edifice so carefully constructed, there was another nice little niche to be filled by a future Supreme Court decision declaring that the Constitution does not permit a state to exclude slavery from its limits. That was all that was needed to make slavery universal. And, Lincoln predicted, It was probably coming, unless the power of the present political dynasty shall be met and overthrown. We shall lie down pleasantly dreaming that the people of Missouri are on the verge of making their state free, he warned, and we shall awake to the reality instead that the Supreme Court has made Illinois a slave state. Lincoln probably genuinely believed in this alleged pro-slavery conspiracy among Northern Democratic leaders because he so totally distrusted Douglas. He thought the senator utterly unprincipled. He was quite ready to believe a wholly undocumented rumor that Douglas was sending certain unknown personages to Illinois in order to arouse the hitherto quiescent temperance movement, in the hope that that issue might divide Republicans. It would be perfectly natural in him, he judged, just like him. Lincoln's suspicion of Douglas was fueled by his rankling envy of his rival. In a fragmentary manuscript discussing his 22 years of acquaintance with Douglas, Lincoln couldn't help making a painful comparison of their careers. With me, the race of ambition has been a failure, a flat failure. With him, it's been one of splendid success. He complained to Joseph Gillespie that Douglas had arrogated a superiority over him on account of his national reputation, adding, a bit wistfully, that if our positions were changed, I wouldn't do that. But his charge of conspiracy wasn't based on fact. Certainly, Douglas and Pierce had cooperated to secure the adoption of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, but Buchanan had been out of the country, and Taney had nothing to do with it. Taney's Dred Scott decision ran directly counter to Douglas's popular sovereignty idea. Lincoln knew as well as anybody else that Douglas and Buchanan were now feuding. But in order to make his case, he had to dismiss the fierce controversy over Lecompton as a squabble, a kind of lover's quarrel. More defensible, though also highly speculative, was Lincoln's prediction of a second Dred Scott decision, which would protect slavery in all the states as well as the national territories. He couldn't have known that Chief Justice Taney, angered by criticism, was eager to issue what he called a supplement to the Dred Scott decision. But as a well-informed lawyer, he realized there were bound to be cases in the near future where the justices would issue further rulings on slavery. It was no secret that the case of Lemon versus the People, involving the right of a Virginia slaveholder to bring his slaves into the state of New York while in transit to Texas, was working its way up to the Supreme Court, and it required no great feat of the imagination to guess how the present justices would rule. But the specifics of Lincoln's conspiracy charge in his house-divided speech were less important than its general import. Its purpose was clear: to show Republicans, both in Illinois and in the East, that Douglas couldn't be trusted and must be defeated. In the brief final section of his speech, Lincoln asked who could best check this headlong rush to nationalize slavery. Surely not Douglas, even though his admirers remind us that he is a very great man and that the largest of us are very small ones. But Douglas's past record of supporting slavery aggressions made him now a caged and toothless lion, and, in an unfortunate phrase, Lincoln reminded his listeners, "A living dog is better than a dead lion." No, the cause of putting slavery on the road to ultimate extinction must be entrusted to and conducted by its own undoubted friends, the Republicans. "The result is not doubtful," he concluded. "We shall not fail. If we stand firm, we shall not fail." Thus, the three sections of Lincoln's House Divided speech had the inevitability of a syllogism. The tendency to nationalize slavery had to be defeated. Stephen A. Douglas powerfully contributed to that tendency. Therefore, Stephen A. Douglas had to be defeated. Attracting national attention, Lincoln's House Divided speech sounded very radical. Advanced 5 months before William H. Seward offered his prediction of an irrepressible conflict between slavery and freedom, it was the most extreme statement made by any responsible leader of the Republican Party. Even Herndon, to whom Lincoln first read it, told his partner, "It's true, but is it wise or politic to say so?" Lincoln's other advisers condemned it, especially deploring the House Divided image and saying the whole spirit was too far in advance of the times. As the editor John Locke Scripps explained, many who heard and read Lincoln's speech understood it as an implied pledge on behalf of the Republican Party to make war upon the institution in the states where it now exists. Aware that his House Divided prediction was controversial, Lincoln, in the months ahead, tried to blunt its impact, telling Scripps that whether the clause used by me will bear such construction or not, I never so intended it. In this passage, he insisted, I didn't say I was in favor of anything. I made a prediction only. It may have been a foolish one, perhaps. But he never disavowed it. He knew it was the necessary first premise in his syllogism, proving that Douglas should be defeated. When Douglas learned that the Republicans were nominating Lincoln, he recognized that he would be up against a formidable opponent. "I shall have my hands full," he told a newspaperman. "He's as honest as he is shrewd, and if I beat him, my victory will be hardly won." He felt obliged to remain in Washington until he finally succeeded in defeating the Lecompton Constitution, and he stayed on in a vain attempt to prevent the passage of Representative William H. English's face-saving measure, endorsed by the Buchanan administration, providing for a referendum on that constitution, which everyone now recognized would be rejected. In July, Douglas returned home to Chicago, and before a huge outdoor audience, offered an extended reply to Lincoln's charges. Announcing themes that he would repeat and develop in the coming campaign, Douglas claimed credit for the defeat of Lecompton, which he said was a vindication of popular sovereignty. That policy of allowing the people of the states and the territories to choose their own institutions, including slavery, was dearer to every true American than any other, and any limitation on it would destroy the fundamental principle of self-government. Referring to Lincoln, who sat on the balcony behind him, as a kind, amiable, and intelligent gentleman, a good citizen, and an honorable opponent, Douglas insisted that he had totally misapprehended the great principles upon which our government rests, and was advocating boldly and clearly a war of sections, a war of the North against the South. Continuing with a defense of the Supreme Court, Douglas insisted that Republicans who attacked the Dred Scott decision ignored the fact that this government of ours is founded on the white basis. It was made by the white man for the benefit of the white man to be administered by white men. In advocating equal rights for the Negro, Republicans failed to understand that any mixture or amalgamation with inferior races could only lead to degeneration, demoralization, and degradation. He ended with a fling at the Buchanan administration and the federal office holders whom it had appointed for entering into an unholy, unnatural alliance with the Republicans. The next night, from the same balcony of the same Chicago hotel, Lincoln replied to Douglas, denouncing his opponent for quibbling about this race and that race and the other race being inferior, and urging a return to the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, the electric cord that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together, as long as the love of freedom exists in the minds of men throughout the world. The exchange in Chicago set a pattern for the next 6 weeks of the campaign. When Douglas set out on an extended election tour of the state, Lincoln followed him at most places, often rising at the end of Douglas's speech to announce that he would make a reply, sometimes later in the evening, but more often the next day. It was, the New York Herald observed, somewhat of an anomaly for a senator of the United States to be stumping the state and another who wishes to be senator following in his wake. Lincoln thought that speaking at the same place the next day after Douglas is the very thing. But his advisers doubted the wisdom of trailing around after the senator. Judd, Lincoln's unofficial campaign manager for Northern Illinois, pointed out that it allowed Douglas constantly to put him on the defensive. A Decatur supporter explained that Douglas's ostentatious arrival attracted crowds from both parties, but that only confirmed Republicans remained after the senator left. In other words, he wrote, Douglas takes the crowd and Lincoln the leavings. Douglas and his supporters were furious at Lincoln for poaching on the audiences that had assembled to hear him. The Illinois State Register claimed that Lincoln did so because he couldn't attract his own crowds. Poor, desperate creature, sneered the Democratic Chicago Times. He wants an audience, and the people won't turn out to hear him. Perhaps he should join one of the two very good circuses and menageries traveling through the state, for they always brought out a considerable audience. Lincoln changed his battle plan after Douglas began devoting more and more time on the stump to attacking Lyman Trumbull, who'd accused him of a corrupt bargain in the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. Seeing that this personal quarrel would divert public attention from his own campaign, he proposed a series of debates with Douglas. The senator was reluctant to agree. He had nothing to gain and much to lose by giving public exposure to his lesser-known rival. Lincoln's challenge came too late, he complained. He already had a heavy schedule of speaking appointments, and he might also be asked to divide time with a potential third candidate nominated by Democrats loyal to Buchanan. At the same time, Douglas knew he couldn't refuse, lest he seem afraid of Lincoln. Grudgingly, he consented to participate in 7 debates, one in each of the Illinois congressional districts, except the 2nd and the 6th, Chicago and Springfield, where the 2 candidates had already appeared. The first of the debates would take place at Ottawa, in the north-central part of the state, on August 21st. The last, at Alton, in the south, along the Mississippi River on October 15th. In between, there were to be debates at Freeport, in the extreme north, August 27th, at Jonesboro in the far south, September 15th, at Charleston in the east-central region, September 18th, at Galesburg in the northwestern section, October 7th, and at Quincy in the west, October 13th. Even though he fussed over details of the arrangements, Lincoln accepted them. His letter gave a rare glimpse of a hard ego that he usually concealed under a guise of humility. He hadn't challenged Douglas earlier, he explained, because I didn't know but that such a proposal would come from you. Debating with Douglas wasn't Lincoln's only occupation during the 1858 campaign. With no secretarial staff, no full-time assistants, no designated campaign manager, he had to decide most of the details of the canvass himself. He raised money, reminding friends who'd expressed an interest in his prospects that now was the time when help was needed. He tried to plant pro-Republican articles in even such minor newspapers as the Paris, Illinois Prairie Beacon, and he supervised the printing and distribution of his campaign speeches in both German and English. Recognizing how weak the Republicans were in southern Illinois, he joined with Trumbull and five other associates in promising to pay the young German-American newspaperman John G. Nicolay $500 to promote the circulation of the St. Louis, Missouri Democrat, which, despite its name, was a staunchly Republican organ, in that part of the state. Much of his time was taken in planning Republican strategy. From the returns in the 1856 election, it was fairly clear that the two Republican candidates for general state offices, those of state treasurer and superintendent of education, would win. But the success of his own race for the Senate depended on the outcome of nearly 100 local elections for the state legislature, over which he could exert little direct influence. The Republicans' task was, therefore, formidable, and at times, as Herndon reported, Lincoln grew gloomy, rather uncertain about his own success. Rather than lamenting his luck, Lincoln prepared to make the best of the situation. He drew up a careful, detailed list of how the representative and senatorial districts had voted in the previous election, and, assuming that the 1856 Fillmore voters would now support Republican candidates, tried to predict how each district would go in 1858. Some, mostly in southern Illinois, he wrote off as desperate, meaning that there was no use wasting Republican resources there. Others, chiefly in the North, he marked, "We take to ourselves without question," so that no campaigning in these counties was needed. He allocated his public appearances accordingly, making only 4 speeches in the North and only 4 in the South. The rest of his time he devoted to districts we must struggle for, mainly in the central part of the state, where the Whig and more recently the Know-Nothing Party had been strongest. Lincoln found his efforts to woo this old Whig vote frustrating. It was a warning of their disaffection that very few former Whigs participated in the Republican county conventions of 1858. Lincoln attempted to check this defection by stressing his long service to the Whig Party, and throughout the campaign claimed to wear the mantle of Henry Clay. But Douglas, too, campaigned as the great Kentuckian's successor in advocating sectional compromise. Lincoln's effort to win over the old-line Whigs was severely damaged when Judge T. Lyle Dickey, one of the most prominent Whigs and hitherto a close friend, announced that he would support Douglas. Lincoln, he said, was too closely allied to the abolitionists. Then Dickey let it leak out that he had a private letter from John J. Crittenden of Kentucky, Clay's political heir in the United States Senate, favoring Douglas. Much troubled, Lincoln wrote Crittenden that though he didn't believe this story, it made him uneasy. To his dismay, Crittenden responded that he did indeed think that Douglas's re-election was necessary as a rebuke to the administration and a vindication of the great cause of popular rights and public justice. Along with the efforts to keep his own fragile coalition together, Lincoln tried to capitalize on divisions among the Democrats. Despite several attempts at compromise, the break between Douglas and Buchanan persisted, and the president and his Southern advisers resolved to help defeat the Illinois senator, partly out of vindictiveness, partly to demonstrate that Democrats mustn't rebel against their party leadership. Buchanan began removing Illinois postmasters and other federal officials appointed because of Douglas's recommendation, replacing them with men known to be inveterate enemies of the senator. He also fostered the creation of a separate national Democratic Party in Illinois. Some of these Danites, as they were derisively called, after an alleged secret order of Mormons who acted as spies to suppress disaffection, openly endorsed Lincoln's election to the Senate. Others favored a separate ticket in order to divide the Democratic vote. Douglas charged that there was a corrupt bargain between these national Democrats and the Republicans, who had nothing in common except a desire to bring about his defeat. In reply to an urgent inquiry from Trumbull, Lincoln replied that, at least as far as he was concerned, there was no alliance with the Buchanan men. To be sure, he was rather pleased to see a division in the ranks of the Democracy, and certainly did nothing to prevent it, but he'd made no agreement with them by which there is to be any concession of principle on either side, or furnishing of the sinews, or partition of offices, or swapping of votes to any extent. He chose his words carefully, as did Herndon, who also gave assurance that there was not any contract, either express or implied, directly or indirectly, with the Danites. Though that was literally the truth, it wasn't the whole truth. Only a few days after Lincoln wrote Trumbull, he met privately with Colonel John Daugherty, the National Democratic candidate for state treasurer, to discuss the election. When Daugherty promised that the National Democrats would field a candidate in every legislative district, Lincoln replied, "If you do this, the thing is settled. The battle's fought." In most of his dealing with the Danites, however, Lincoln preferred to keep his hands clean by working through an intermediary. Herndon was one of the best, because his brother, Elliot Herndon, was editor of the Illinois State Democrat, the national Democratic newspaper in Springfield, and his father was also a strong supporter of Buchanan. "They make no bones in telling me what they're going to do," Herndon boasted. He understood the importance of keeping Lincoln in the dark about these conversations. As he told Trumbull, "Lincoln doesn't know the details of how we get along. I do, but he doesn't." As the campaign progressed, ties between the Republicans and the National Democrats became even closer. In September, so few Danites turned out for their party convention that Republicans had to pack the hall to keep it from becoming a joke. At this meeting, as Jesse Dubois reported to Lincoln, "Republicans worked through your man to learn the National Democrats' campaign strategy." The underfinanced publisher of the Illinois State Democrat told one of his unpaid employees that he expected $500 of Mr. Lincoln in a day or two, which may or may not have been true. Lincoln couldn't stay in his office to manage the campaign because he was constantly in demand as a speaker. Day after day, both Democrats and Republicans held rallies all across the state. Republican foot soldiers were deployed to the smaller gatherings in schoolhouses and village churches. At larger rallies, Republicans often produced out-of-state dignitaries, like Governor Salmon P. Chase of Ohio, Representative Schuyler Colfax from nearby Indiana, and Francis P. Frank Blair, Jr., of the prominent border state political family, who was editor of the influential St. Louis Democrat. Democrats felt less need to import speakers, though Representative Clement L. Vallandigham of Ohio made several speeches for Douglas in Illinois. But Illinois voters wanted to hear the principals, not their surrogates. And both Lincoln and Douglas were almost constantly on the stump. Douglas gave 130 speeches during the campaign, and Lincoln 63, not including short responses to serenaders, remarks to small groups that assembled along the highways, and compliments paid to the standard Republican floats, featuring 32 ladies, one for each state plus Kansas, which almost every village seemed able to produce. In the 100 days before the election, Douglas traveled 5,227 miles, and Lincoln, between July and November, covered 4,350 miles, 350 by boat, 600 by carriage, and 3,400 by train. The seven formal debates between Lincoln and Douglas were, therefore, only a small part of the 1858 campaign, though they naturally attracted the greatest interest. All of them followed the same format. The speakers alternated in opening the debate. The opening speaker was allowed an hour for his presentation. His opponent had an hour and a half for reply, and the initial speaker then had a final half hour for rebuttal. Lincoln grumbled that the arrangement allowed Douglas to make four of the opening and closing statements, while he was allowed only three. As the Republican New York Times observed, Illinois in 1858 was the most interesting political battleground in the Union, and newspapers throughout the country offered extensive coverage of the canvass. Local papers, of course, gave it great attention. For the first time, reporters were assigned to cover candidates throughout the long campaign season. The Chicago Press and Tribune, the most influential Republican paper in the state, sent the skilled shorthand expert Robert R. Hitt to report every word of the debates, and James B. Sheridan and Henry Binmore performed the same service for Douglas's organ, the Chicago Times. Though each side accused the other of garbling, mutilating, or revising the speeches, the verbatim reports, which were widely copied and circulated in other newspapers as well, were largely accurate, both in substance and in expression. Reporters noted how sharply the candidates contrasted in appearance. Douglas, so short that he came up only to Lincoln's shoulder, was a ruddy, stout man with regular features marred only by a curious horizontal ridge that stretched across the top of his nose, while Lincoln was exceptionally tall and painfully thin, with a melancholy physiognomy and sallow skin. Douglas had a booming, authoritative voice, while Lincoln spoke in a piercing tenor, which at times became shrill and sharp. Douglas used graceful gestures and bowed charmingly when applauded, in contrast to Lincoln, who moved his arms and hands awkwardly and looked like a jackknife folding up when he tried to bow. There was also a marked contrast in the way the candidates presented themselves to the public. Douglas wished to appear a commanding figure, a statesman of national reputation. Accompanied by his beautiful, regal second wife, Adele Cutts, he usually traveled by special train, splendidly fitted out for comfort and for entertaining. When he stood on the platform in his handsome new blue suit with silver buttons and in his immaculate linen, he was unquestionably a great United States senator reporting to his loyal constituents. Lincoln deliberately cultivated a different image. When he went by train, he traveled in the regular passenger cars, a practice that afforded him endless opportunities for meeting the voters and talking about their concerns. Except at the final debate in Alton, Mary Lincoln didn't accompany him. It wasn't part of the persona he was projecting to display his elegantly dressed wife with her aristocratic bearing. Lincoln took pains to wear his everyday clothes during the debates, appearing usually in what Carl Schurz, the German-American leader who campaigned for the Republican ticket, described as a rusty black frock coat with sleeves that should have been longer, and black trousers that permitted a very full view of his large feet. From time to time, Lincoln tried to capitalize on the differences between Douglas's appearance and his own. The senator's followers, he said, anticipated that their leader at no distant day would become president, and saw in his round, jolly, fruitful face promises of post offices, land offices, marshalships and cabinet appointments, charge ships and foreign missions bursting and sprouting out in wonderful exuberance. While in Lincoln's poor, lean, lank face, nobody ever saw that any cabbages were sprouting out, because nobody's ever expected me to be president. There was nothing false about this. Lincoln was, in fact, a homely man with simple tastes, indifferent to personal comfort. It was important in this contest to present himself to the voters not as a man of considerable means and one of the most prominent lawyers in the state, but as a countryman, shrewd and incorruptible. The opening debate at Ottawa, a town of about 9,000 inhabitants, some 80 miles southwest of Chicago, attracted 10,000 people, who came in on foot, by horseback or carriage, and even on Illinois River canal boats. A special train of 17 cars brought visitors from Chicago, and another of 11 cars came from Peru and La Salle. Lincoln arrived about noon on the special train from Chicago and was greeted by Ottawa Mayor Joseph O. Glover. Seated in a carriage that, according to the Chicago Press and Tribune, was beautifully decorated with evergreens and mottos by the young ladies of Ottawa, he was escorted by a procession of military companies and brass bands, which stretched out for half a mile, to the public square, and then to Mayor Glover's house. At about the same time, a rival crowd went out to meet Douglas, who rode in from Peru in a handsome carriage drawn by four spirited horses. By 1 o'clock, people began moving into Lafayette Square, where the speaking was to take place, and there was considerable jostling for the best positions. There were no seats, and the audience had to remain standing for the entire 3 hours. Some clowns climbed upon the roof of the hastily built speaker's stand, the newspapers reported, and their weight broke through the boards, which fell on the unsuspecting heads of members of the reception committee. Fortunately, order was restored in time for Douglas to begin speaking at 2:30. The ferocity of Douglas's opening statement apparently startled Lincoln. The senator intended to demonstrate that he was, as Lincoln had said, a lion, and very much a living lion with sharp teeth. Announcing his major theme, which he'd pursue throughout the campaign, the senator bluntly charged that Lincoln and Trumbull had, since 1854, been conspiring to subvert both the Democratic and the Whig parties in order to create an abolition party under the name and disguise of a Republican party. As evidence of this intent, he adduced a radical anti-slavery platform, which he said had been adopted in 1854 at the first state convention of the Republican Party in Springfield, and which Lincoln had presumably endorsed. Like a prosecuting attorney pinning down a reluctant witness, he demanded to know whether Lincoln still stood on this platform. Did Lincoln now, as in 1854, favor the unconditional repeal of the Fugitive Slave Act? Did he oppose the admission of more slave states to the Union? Was he opposed to the admission of a new state with such a constitution as the people of that state may see fit to make? Did he support the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia? Was he pledged to end the interstate slave trade? Did he wish to prohibit slavery in all the national territories? Did he oppose the acquisition of additional territory unless slavery was prohibited in it? Lincoln, he charged, was in favor of suppressing self-government and imposing uniformity on the different states, a policy never dreamed of by Washington, Madison, or the framers of this government. How to reply bewildered Lincoln. At his best, when he had time carefully to think through his ideas and revise his phrasing, he was clearly uncomfortable in debate format, which required extemporaneous speaking and swift rearrangement of arguments to meet the opponent's charges. Rather stumblingly, he declared that he'd had nothing to do with the 1854 resolutions Douglas had read, and that his name had been used in connection with them without his authority. To establish that his true position on slavery was a very moderate one, he read at great length from his 1854 Peoria speech, in which he denounced that, given all earthly power, he wouldn't know what to do about ending slavery. Lincoln rushed through his speech, failing to use much of the time allotted to him. He had difficulty striking exactly the right tone. At times he resorted to worn clichés of humor, calling Douglas's misrepresentations of his views on race an example of that specious and fantastic arrangement of words by which a man can prove a horse chestnut to be a chestnut horse. He lapsed into legal language that must have been all but incomprehensible to his audience. Because Douglas hadn't denied the charge that he was part of a pro-slavery conspiracy, Lincoln said, in the language of the lawyers, I took a default on him. Then, when Douglas did produce a belated denial, Lincoln continued, I demur to that plea. I waive all objections that it wasn't filed till after default was taken, and demur to it upon the merits. He declined to give immediate answers to Douglas's questions, even though his position on all these issues had been firmly established for years. His native caution was so great that he delayed his response until the next debate, declaring, I don't mean to allow him to catechize me unless he pays back for it in kind. After Douglas's rebuttal, most in the audience hunted up any missing members of the family and made a break for home, where the horses had to be watered and the cattle fed. More dedicated partisans gathered around to congratulate the rival candidates. As Douglas left the stand, according to the partisan Illinois State Register, nearly the entire crowd pressed around him, and the living mass, with shouts and hurrahs, bore him in their midst to the hotel, the cheering and shouting being kept up incessantly. Lincoln's partisans were equally enthusiastic, and, in what proved to be an unfortunate effort to show approval, a dozen or so sturdy Republicans put him on their shoulders and, preceded by a band, carried him to the mayor's house. He was clearly uncomfortable, and the hostile reporter, Henry Villard, thought it was a ludicrous sight to see Lincoln's grotesque figure holding frantically onto the heads of his supporters, while his legs were dangling from their shoulders and his pantaloons pulled up so as to expose his underwear almost to his knees. Some of Lincoln's friends feared that he'd expose more than that at the Ottawa debate. A few, like Richard Yates, reported that they were well satisfied with his performance, and Lincoln himself was reasonably content with the outcome, reporting the next day, "The fire flew some, and I'm glad to know I'm yet alive." But most of his advisers thought he hadn't been sufficiently forceful or aggressive. Ray, about to leave on a business trip to New York, and joined Congressman Washburn, "When you see Abe at Freeport, for God's sake tell him to charge, Chester, charge. Don't let him keep on the defensive." Joseph Medill, of the same newspaper, also urged Lincoln to change his tactics. "Don't act on the defensive at all," he urged. "Don't refer to your past speeches or positions, but hold Doug up as a traitor and conspirator, a pro-slavery, bamboozling demagogue." On reflection, Lincoln himself was sufficiently worried about his performance at Ottawa to call a kind of summit meeting of his advisers to discuss how he should respond to Douglas's interrogatories. Gathering in Chicago on August 26th, they called for a reconsideration of Lincoln's campaign strategy, and Medill, reporting for his colleagues, told Lincoln that he should put a few ugly questions of his own to Douglas the next day at Freeport. At Freeport, Lincoln was clearly more in charge than he'd been at Ottawa only a week earlier. Before this sympathetic, vast audience as strongly tending to abolitionism as any audience in the state of Illinois, he turned first to answering the interrogatories Douglas had posed at Ottawa. His answers contained no surprises. He was not in favor of repeal of the Fugitive Slave Act. He did not stand pledged against the admission of additional slave states to the Union, though he'd be exceedingly sorry to have to pass on that question, nor against the admission of a new state, with whatever constitution its inhabitants might see fit to make. He did not stand today pledged to the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia, but he would be very glad to see it accomplished, or the prohibition of the interstate slave trade, though he admitted that he'd not thought much about this subject. He was, on the other hand, impliedly, if not expressly, pledged to prohibit slavery in all federal territories. As to acquiring additional territory, he would or would not oppose such acquisition, depending on whether it would or would not aggravate the slavery question among ourselves. Then, finally taking the offensive, he posed to Douglas four questions of his own. Four questions that were much like those that his Chicago advisers had recommended. First, would Douglas favor the admission of Kansas before it had the requisite number of inhabitants, as specified in the English bill? Second, could the people of a United States territory in any lawful way exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution? Third, would Douglas acquiesce in and follow a decision of the Supreme Court declaring that states could not exclude slavery from their limits? Finally, did he favor acquisition of additional territory in disregard of how such acquisition may affect the nation on the slavery question? The second was the key question. Though advisers like Medill urged him to raise it, Lincoln had hesitated before asking it. He was in no doubt about how Douglas would answer, and just as he expected, Douglas promptly replied that the passage of unfriendly legislation could keep slavery out of any territory because slavery cannot exist a day or an hour anywhere unless it's supported by local police regulations. Consequently, as Mr. Lincoln has heard me answer 100 times from every stump in Illinois, the people of a territory can, by lawful means, exclude slavery from their limits prior to the formation of a state constitution. Though Lincoln predicted this reply, which became known as the Freeport Doctrine, he thought it important to have Douglas state it explicitly. Otherwise, as he wrote a friend, it would be hard work to get him directly to the point. As long as Douglas could fudge the issue, he could pretend that he was loyal to the National Party and even to the National Administration. But when he was forced to make his position clear, he'd further outrage President Buchanan and his advisers, who believed that the Dred Scott decision had killed popular sovereignty, and his stand would widen the division between Douglas Democrats and the Danites in Illinois. But by showing how greatly at odds Douglas was with the national democracy, Lincoln risked undermining his basic argument that Douglas was part of a broad conspiracy to extend and perpetuate slavery. Nevertheless, pressed to take the offensive and realizing that this question might rattle his opponent, Lincoln decided to include the question. Then, taking advantage of the research that Herndon and others had done for him in the Springfield newspapers, Lincoln dropped his bombshell. The abolition resolutions that Douglas had so elaborately read at Ottawa, which Lincoln allegedly endorsed, were not, as it turned out, ever adopted by any group in Springfield, much less at any meeting that Lincoln attended. They were passed by a convention or public meeting in Kane County. Indignantly, Lincoln announced that it was most extraordinary that Douglas should so far forget all the suggestions of justice to an adversary or of prudence to himself as to venture upon the assertion concerning these resolutions, which the slightest investigation would have shown him to be wholly false. The revelation momentarily disconcerted Douglas, but he was such a skilled debater that he quickly recovered. Using diversionary tactics, he charged that Lincoln was avoiding either endorsing or repudiating these abolitionist resolutions by claiming that the platform hadn't been adopted on the right spot. And that gave him an opportunity to attack Lincoln's spot resolutions criticizing the Mexican War. Sensing that this tactic was failing, he provoked the audience by repeatedly calling them black Republicans. When they began chanting white, white every time he used the phrase, he denounced them, announcing proudly, "I've seen your mobs before and defy your wrath." Nearly everyone agreed that Lincoln made a stronger showing at Freeport than in the first debate, and his devoted supporters, like Herndon, were convinced that so far Lincoln has the decided advantage in the contest. One distant admirer, a writer in the Lowell, Massachusetts Journal and Courier, even announced that Lincoln's speeches were so telling that people were now calculating his fitness and chances for a more elevated position. But Washburn, a more objective reporter, found after the Freeport debate that neither party was fully satisfied with the speeches, and the meeting broke up without any display of enthusiasm. In a confidential letter, Medill confessed that Lincoln wasn't Douglas's equal on the stump, and predicted the senator would be reelected. Nearly all the Republicans felt relieved that Lyman Trumbull, who was considered a better speaker and had a wider reputation than Lincoln, had returned from Washington to assist the Republican cause. Lincoln knew he was at a disadvantage in the third debate at Jonesboro, an isolated town of 842 inhabitants in Union County, in the extreme southern part of the state. Settled by Southerners who'd migrated chiefly from Kentucky and Tennessee, Egypt was solidly Democratic and overwhelmingly Negrophobic. Rural, mostly poor, and relatively untouched by commercial ambition, voters in Union County had little use for the Republican Party and its candidate. Fewer than 2,000 listeners attended the debate. Lincoln and Douglas rehashed the issues they'd raised in the previous debates, developing few ideas and adding little new information. Furious that Trumbull, that excrescence from the rotten bowels of the democracy, was now taking such a prominent part in the campaign, Douglas renewed his charge that Lincoln and Trumbull had conspired to abolitionize both parties in Illinois. And he now added, in the hope of dividing his opponents, the accusation that Trumbull, in the 1855 election, had played a Yankee trick on Lincoln in order to secure his own rather than Lincoln's election to the Senate that year. Then, in an effort to goad Lincoln into responding, he elaborated on some of the racist charges he'd made earlier in the campaign, announcing that the signers of the Declaration of Independence had no reference to the Negro whatever when they declared all men to be created equal. Shrewdly, Lincoln refused to be baited. He knew there was no possibility of persuading this audience, very few of whom are my political friends, he noted, and he avoided the issue of equal rights for Negroes. Much of his time he devoted to attacking Douglas's Freeport Doctrine, which threatened the credibility of Lincoln's charge that the senator was engaged in a conspiracy to expand slavery. Lincoln insisted that Douglas's claim that slavery couldn't enter a new territory without police protection was historically false, for there was vigor enough in slavery to plant itself in a new country even against unfriendly legislation. At Charleston, 3 days later, he was on more hospitable ground. Many in Coles County had known Thomas Lincoln and his family, and some enthusiasts spread a gigantic painting 80 feet long across the main street showing Old Abe 30 years ago on a Kentucky wagon pulled by 3 yoke of oxen. Democrats countered with a banner captioned Negro Equality, which depicted a white man standing with a Negro woman and a mulatto boy in the background. Republicans found this so offensive that they tore it down before allowing the debate to begin. Lincoln picked up on that theme in his opening remarks. He had, he said, recently been approached by an elderly man who wanted to know whether he was in favor of perfect equality between blacks and whites. this probably hypothetical inquiry gave him the opportunity to make his views explicit in a community where conservative old Whigs were strong. I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, he announced. I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. There is a physical difference between the white and black races which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality, he went on to add. This was a politically expedient thing to say in a state where the majority of the inhabitants were of Southern origin. Perhaps it was a necessary thing to say in a state where only 10 years earlier, 70% of the voters had favored a constitutional amendment to exclude all blacks from Illinois. It also represented Lincoln's deeply held personal views, which he'd repeatedly expressed before. Opposed to slavery throughout his life, he'd given little thought to the status of free African Americans. Unlike many of his contemporaries, he wasn't personally hostile to blacks. Indeed, Frederick Douglass remarked on his entire freedom from popular prejudice against the colored race. But he didn't know whether they could ever fit into a free society, and, rather vaguely, he continued to think of colonization as the best solution to the American race problem. Turning from this subject abruptly, Lincoln inexplicably devoted most of his Charleston opening speech to endorsing a charge, originally made by Trumbull, that Douglass, despite his protestations of opposition to the Lecompton Constitution, had really been part of a plot to impose slavery on Kansas. The story was intricate and confusing, involving secret proceedings in Senate committees and parliamentary maneuvering in the Senate itself, and Douglas had flatly announced that Trumbull's evidence for the alleged plot was forged from beginning to end. Unwilling to see Trumbull calumniated, Lincoln now leapt to his defense with a tedious and unconvincing review of the charge. Douglas expressed amazement that Lincoln had spent nearly his entire time on this discredited issue. Rather petulantly, he asked, "Why, I ask, does not Mr. Lincoln make a speech of his own instead of taking up his time reading Trumbull's speech?" Scornfully, he declared, "I thought I was running against Abraham Lincoln, that he claimed to be my opponent." It was, he concluded, unbecoming the dignity of a canvass to spend time on these petty personal matters. After Charleston, the lowest point in his campaign, Lincoln made a splendid recovery in the final three engagements with Douglas. The debate at Galesburg, which took place on the campus of Knox College, attracted one of the largest crowds, and in this anti-slavery area, heavily settled by Scandinavians, the audience was enthusiastic for the Republican candidate. Douglas, who was clearly tiring in the protracted campaign and was beginning to lose his voice, gave his standard speech, defending his unfailing fidelity in supporting the right of self-government and bitterly attacking the unholy and unnatural combination of Republicans and National Democrats against him. Lincoln, he claimed, was a political chameleon, advocating bold and radical abolitionism in the extreme northern part of Illinois, but professing in the central and southern counties to be an old-line Whig, a disciple of Henry Clay. At Chicago, Lincoln announced his belief in Negro equality, but at Charleston, he declared that there must be a superior and an inferior race. By contrast, Douglas asserted his own views were clear and fixed. He knew that the authors of the Declaration of Independence never intended to include the Negro, and that this government was made by our fathers on the white basis, made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever. In his reply, Lincoln was in good voice and in high spirits. He seemed to thrive on campaigning rather than being exhausted from it. Sensing that his audience was on his side, he appeared almost joyful as he rebutted Douglas's charges, most of which, he noted, had previously been delivered and put in print. Douglas had been guilty of slandering the Founding Fathers, for the entire records of the world from the date of the Declaration of Independence up to within 3 years ago may be searched in vain for one single affirmation from one single man that the Negro was not included in the Declaration of Independence. Similarly, he'd misrepresented Lincoln's views on race because there was no conflict whatever between his view that it was impossible to produce perfect social and political equality between black and white races and his insistence that the inferior races were equal in their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He taunted Douglas on his repeated failure to repudiate the alleged Republican resolutions of 1854, which he'd tried ever since the Ottawa debate to attach to Lincoln. In constantly reusing this stale fraud, he was like the fisherman's wife whose drowned husband was brought home with his body full of eels. Said she, when she was asked what's to be done with him, "Take the eels out and set him again." Then, becoming serious, he again charged, without questioning motives at all, that Douglas was part of a plan to make slavery national. To do this, Douglas was willing to distort history and to rewrite the story of the American Revolution. He was going back to the era of our liberty and independence and, so far as in him lies, muzzling the cannon that thunders its annual joyous return. "He's blowing out the moral lights around us," Lincoln continued, borrowing a phrase from Henry Clay. "He's eradicating the light of reason and the love of liberty in order to perpetuate slavery. Soon he would even extend it by making a grab for the territory of poor Mexico, an invasion of the rich lands of South America, then the adjoining islands." At Quincy, a week later, each candidate went over the familiar arguments and neither introduced many new ideas. Not until nearly the end of Lincoln's opening speech did he again state what he believed was the fundamental issue of the campaign: the difference between the men who think slavery a wrong and those who do not think it wrong. Republicans believed that it was a moral, a social, and a political wrong, and wanted to limit its spread. The Democratic Party, on the other hand, did not think slavery was a wrong, and Douglas, its leading man, had the high distinction, so far as I know, of never having said slavery is either right or wrong. Douglas, in reply, defended his record and once again charged that Lincoln held one set of principles in the abolition counties and a different and contradictory set in the other counties. He called the Dred Scott decision one from which there's no appeal this side of heaven, and charged that Lincoln was stirring up opposition to the Supreme Court and stimulating the passions of men to resort to violence and to mobs instead of to law. in the only new gambit in the debate, he suggested that Lincoln's plan to contain slavery was really genocidal, because it meant confining slaves to land where they couldn't support themselves. Thus, by putting slavery on the course of ultimate extinction, he really meant extinguishing the Negro race. This, he jibed, is the humane and Christian remedy that he proposes for the great crime of slavery. Earnestly, Douglas besought his listeners to return to the basic principle of self-government. If they recognized, as the fathers of the nation had always recognized, that this republic can exist forever divided into free and slave states, Americans could get on with their great mission of filling up our prairies, clearing our wildernesses, and building cities, towns, railroads, and other internal improvements, and thus make this the asylum of the oppressed of the whole earth. Lincoln, in his rebuttal, seized upon Douglas's admission that his system of policy in regard to the institution of slavery contemplates that it shall last forever. That, he said, proved what he'd been arguing all along about the Democratic candidate.
This ends Disc 12.